MacCast, Sunday, November 6th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you had a great week. Things are going pretty good around here at MacCast HQ. I guess that's what we'll call it this week, at least. I am having a good time and just following up on a bunch of Apple news information and, of course, your thoughts and emails and questions and things like that. We're going to get to all of those. Big part of this episode, I think, is going to be taken up with reactions both from the media and from blogs and things like that to the new MacBook Pro. Also, your reactions to the new MacBook Pro and Apple's announcements, just in general, what's happening with the state of the Macintosh in our community. We're also going to dig into some other Apple news, of course. We've got things related to tablet market share. We've got what's happening with the next generation of iPhone, or potentially happening, I guess, because it's all rumors at this point. Some things going on with Apple Music and its lead up to the holidays, and what's happening in smartwatches, along with some small updates related to Apple's AirPods. We talked about a little bit about those, I think, on the last episode of the MacCast. And then we're going to get to some more tips and tricks. I've got something related to star ratings maybe coming back in iOS. Also, we're going to talk a little bit about app thinning. If you don't know what that is, we'll dig into that. Gary has a question about the Photos app and using that with third-party stuff. And I have a cool tip for you if you maybe want to test out Apple's new Touch Bar. And guess what? You may not have to spend money on a new machine or wait to test it out. So stay tuned for that. But before we get into all of it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. And I've got a new sponsor here on the MacCast. And, you know, okay, I have to be honest. I am not the kind of guy who ever gave much thought to my underwear, to what I was wearing under my clothes. I know you find it shocking, but I really haven't. I usually just buy what's ever on sale, right? I mean, that's what a lot of us do. Well, with my new sponsor, that has all changed. You know what? This stuff matters. And it's because Tommy John, they're the new sponsor, they sent me their boxer brief starter kit. And I think it's not going out of the realm of reality to say it changed my life. It really does make a difference. Who knew? Quality matters, fit matters, comfort matters. These things all matter. They have this, what they call second skin undershirt and boxer brief, and they match the name of the product. It almost felt like there was nothing there. Of course, you have coverage, you have support, you have all the things you want in an undergarment, but the fabrics are amazing. They spend a lot of time figuring out the right blends. They're incredibly comfortable, incredibly cool, and have, I think, just the right amount of stretch. So it's form-fitting, but stretchy enough that it's comfortable, and it stays in place, which that's kind of the key, right? When you have other fabrics that are just, you know, whatever you bought off the shelf, they don't always kind of stay in place. They tend to maybe move into areas where you really don't want them, if you take my meaning, and you're not going to feel that with the stuff from Tommy John. It's a night and day difference from the bunchy, bulky cotton stuff that I normally wear. And it's weird that, I know, I can appreciate technology, the technology that goes into my Apple stuff, and I'm willing to pay for that technology and that quality, but I never really considered doing the same for the clothes I wear. And I think a little bit differently now. And so you really should give Tommy John a try and see what you think. They even have a best pair guarantee, meaning that if their underwear isn't the best you've ever worn, it's on them. So you really have nothing to lose. Plus, because you're a MacCast listener, you can get 20% off your first purchase And all shipping in the continental U.S. for all of their orders over $50 is always free. So great way to try them out. Try out Tommy John for yourself and get 20% off your first order. Visit TommyJohn.com/MacCast. That's TommyJohn.com/MacCast. And then just use the promo code MacCast, MacCast, at checkout, and you'll get your discount and a great set of underwear. I guarantee you're really going to like the stuff, and they do too. So big thank you to Tommy John for their support of the MacCast. Now, anytime Apple has a new product announcement, of course, the community, the press, they have a lot of things to say about that. But I can't think of a product announcement that has happened in a while that has generated kind of the reaction or the response that the new MacBook Pro announcements have. I think this announcement, more than any other, has left a lot of people scratching their heads, asking a lot of questions, trying to make sense of what's going on with not just Apple, but more specifically the Macintosh and the whole Macintosh line. And we saw a lot of that happening in the news this week, starting off with Ming-Chi Kuo, who says that Apple may be seeing slow demand with the new MacBook Pro models due to high pricing and specs that he says are not really appealing to the core Mac community. We've been getting a lot of that reaction. There were a lot of people that immediately reacted, said, really, this isn't enough. This isn't exciting enough. This is targeted at pros, or Apple says this is targeted at pros, but there's not enough pro features, things like RAM, processors, all those sorts of things. And Ming-Chi Kuo was calling the reactions, quote unquote, tepid. He also cited some of those other complaints that we were hearing from the internet, like switching to USB-C as the standard port, you know, has brought on a lot of people complaining about dongles, the missing SD card slot, and again, the lack of 32 gigabyte options for RAM has meant that people aren't really going to flock to, at least in his opinion, this new MacBook Pro. And so he expects that Apple may at some point have to lower prices on the MacBook Pro, maybe sometime in 2017, in the second half of the year, to kind of compensate for a slowdown or a less than stellar round of sales. And he also thinks there may be a refresh in the CPUs in the second half of 2017 as new processors become available from Intel, the Cannon Lake processors, if they arrive on schedule. This is part of the problem that led into what we saw at the event. And he thinks that might happen, which would then allow possibly for these 32 gigabyte models, possibly bringing sales back up again. But I don't know that everybody shares sort of his thoughts and his reactions. Of course, Apple doesn't. Despite what Kuo thinks, Apple's Phil Schiller said that the company has received more online orders for the new MacBook Pro than ever before, far more than any previous generation of the MacBook Pro. I kind of take a look at that and I go, okay, that may be a sign that there actually is a lot of demand for this, but I think there was also a lot of pent-up demand because of Apple delaying the time between cycles of the MacBook Pro. So these early orders, I think, are a lot of early adopters. There are a lot of people that have been waiting on an update to the MacBook Pro for a while, so they've been sitting on their money ready to spend it, and here's the new product, so they're diving in. So I don't know that we can immediately say, just because the numbers are higher initially, that this means this is going to be kind of the best MacBook Pro in terms of sales that there's ever been. But early indications are a lot of people are buying the MacBook Pro for whatever reason. And there's just this general feeling that the machine has been, you know, at least in the media, again, these aren't necessarily my reactions, I'll talk about those later, but in the media, in what's being said and what we're seeing online, in terms of reactions, there's a general feeling that the machine has been a bunch of compromises made by Apple, and a lot of them forced on them by their reliance on Intel. Intel changed their processor strategy as you may know, and they also kind of slipped the release schedule for their next generation Kaby Lake processors. So Kaby Lake is another tick cycle. There's, you know, in the what used to be a tick-tock cycle, so you'd have a major update to the processor line and then kind of a minor update and then another major update. They seem to be moving to this cycle of doing a major change, a major design change, and then doing kind of two minor ones. So we're kind of in the second round. I think Kaby Lake is the second round of this sort of talk tick tick cycle. And also at this point, the quad core versions of the Kaby Lake processors aren't available. So those are typically the ones that Apple wants to put in the higher end, like the 15-inch model of the MacBook Pro. So for a number of reasons, Apple winds up kind of sticking with current generation technology, which is Skylake. And that leaves a lot of people in the community saying, well, why didn't they go with the Kaby Lake processors that were available? Because there are some that are available right now. It's just the dual core versions. And they use the same 14 nanometer process like the Skylake. So why not just move to that? And beyond the fact that they can't get quad-core versions, there's a number of other reasons. It's just not that big of an update. Some of the smaller tweaks that they built into Kaby Lake are support for high-definition video, 4K video playback specifically, and also some optimizations for VR. And those are just things that aren't really part of Apple's laptop lineup. Sure, 4K video playback would be good, but the problem with the Kaby Lake processors that are out now is they don't offer Intel's better integrated Iris graphics. They don't have the Iris GPUs, and Apple like seems to prefer those over the Intel HD graphics, which are in the processors, the Kaby Lake processors that are currently available. So for those couple of reasons, quad-core not being there, the Iris graphics not being there, Apple kind of opted out this round and said, no, we're going to stick with what is available, what we know is good, and that's the Skylake processors. And so some people see that as Apple kind of compromising on the CPU. An area where it wasn't at first thought that Apple really made some compromises was with the port selection. They threw in four, what Apple is calling Thunderbolt 3 ports. It's really four USB-C ports, which USB-C, the connector, at least for USB-C, can also carry Thunderbolt 3. It's the same connector. So Apple doing a little marketing, sort of marketing speak there. But the point is you've got these four standardized ports, which are very flexible. They're very high speed. They can carry all kinds of signals. But after Apple made their announcements, and this was something they really didn't talk about during the event, it came out that on at least the lower end 13-inch MacBook Pro, the kind of entry-level model, the one that has four ports, not all of the ports were created equal. With the dual-core processor, they only have 12 PCIe lanes available, which means they can't have all of them driving with the controllers that they have in there. They can't have them all driving full-speed Thunderbolt 3. So you have the two ports on the right-hand side that are using what Apple calls reduced bandwidth. They don't talk about how much that bandwidth is reduced, but apparently that's why that limitation exists there. And again, I don't think this is a really big deal, but it certainly is something that Apple didn't speak about. And once again, when you have the internet community looking at what's going on there, they point to this and kind of say, oh, there's another compromise that's sort of being made. And then you have the whole RAM issue, right? It's like, why can't we get the option for 32 gigabytes of RAM? Well, again, Phil Schiller came out publicly and said, look, we made that decision because it's a power consumption decision. But he didn't give a lot of details. So again, the community jumps on there and says, well, what if I am willing to opt for lower battery life to get more RAM because this is a pro machine and I want to put more RAM in there? Well, it turns out Apple made a pretty good design decision here, a pretty smart design decision here. But once again, it was based on the Skylake processor. The Skylake processor only has support for LPDDR3 memory, which sets that memory limit for the RAM at 16 gigabytes. If you want to have the lower power consumption, which is really important for Apple in their notebook lineup. They could have gone with memory that wouldn't need the low power, but then you'd have significantly reduced battery life. So it's the difference, from what I'm reading, it could be the difference between like 10 hours of battery life in your notebook versus about half that, 5 or 6. And that's a pretty big deal. A lot of pros would not be happy if they were only getting 5 or 6 hours of battery life out of their machine. So I think in that case, again, the community sees it as a compromise, but I think it was a smart one. I think it was a good one for Apple to make. And as far as the RAM goes, there seems to be some evidence that most users, most pro users, even wouldn't be able to kind of max out or go beyond the 16 gigabytes of RAM. Yes, there's going to be some exceptions, but Jonathan Zdziarski, and I'm sorry if I mutilated his last name, did some testing on his 16 gigabyte MacBook Pro, and he found that it was pretty hard to actually redline the RAM. He opened up about 30 quote-unquote pro and other apps simultaneously on his machine and was only able to get up to about 15 or 14.5 gigabytes of RAM in use before things kind of started to page out. And in case you're thinking, well, he wasn't using really pro apps, he was using some significant apps, things like VMware with 2 virtual machines running, Photoshop Creative Cloud Edition with 4 36 megapixel multi-layer photos, which were a gigabyte each, opened up, a 22-page Adobe InDesign document, Xcode with 4 production Objective-C projects running, compiling and testing those things, Word, PowerPoint, multiple browsers, preview with PDFs open. You kind of get the point. I mean, he put the thing through its paces, and it really didn't break down. You know, Apple has done some amazing things with their technology. Because they can control the hardware and the software together, the operating system does a really good job of managing memory and making sure that things are running smoothly. Yes, he didn't run Final Cut with multiple 4K, 5K video projects running, and it probably would break down pretty quickly at that point. But with the exception of a few kinds of users, who really does that on a MacBook Pro? You're going to turn to some sort of desktop machine, a Mac Pro, or an iMac before, you know, that's really going to make a difference. So, and really that's not the point. You know, all the brouhaha over RAM is likely not necessary with this machine. That's kind of the point, is this is really targeted, again, at the broader range of quote-unquote pro users and not small niche segments. And, you know, that's kind of where I think some of the conversation in the community is getting to, though, is the fact that here Apple brought out this machine, but didn't really address the elephant in the room, which is the desktop systems, the Mac Pro, the iMac, which would be typically the machines that, again, when the portable isn't the right solution, they're going to be the ones that you maybe turn to. And also, when we start getting into the nitty-gritty of performance, on the surface at least, it looks like the new machines aren't that big a leap over the old ones, and we have that whole pricing thing that we've talked about, right? These are more expensive. Apple raised the prices, and not insignificantly. So when looking at Geekbench scores on the 13-inch base model, which is all we have to go off of right now because the Touch Bar machines, the mid-range and higher-end machines aren't out now, they look to have about the same Geekbench scores as the 2015 early MacBook Pro models. The single-core scores are between 3,700 around 3,700, and the multi-core scores seem to be around 7,200. Now, the new machine has a 2.0 gigahertz dual-core Intel Core i5 processor. The old one had a 2.7 gigahertz dual-core Intel Core i5. So you've got better power efficiency and some other advantages. But because of the price difference, $500, and you're not even getting the Touch Bar yet, it kind of makes you wonder, what are we really paying for? And if you step back from looking at just the benchmarks, you realize, okay, it does have 2 Thunderbolt 3 ports. It's thinner, smaller, lighter. All of these things are advantages. And the Geekbench really doesn't show anything beyond raw numbers, raw processor numbers. We're not getting real world numbers. And the new models, and this is very important to consider, they have super fast SSDs and RAM. And that's where these things are going to make a much bigger difference. As a matter of fact, now that some people are doing some analysis, the SSDs that Apple has put in these new model MacBooks are looking to be some of the fastest on the market. Computer World had tested the 2015 13-inch MacBook Pro model. They found that in doing the Blackmagic tests, it had write speeds of about 1.4 gigabits per second and read speeds around 1.3 gigabits per second. But for the new machines, Apple is saying they will have read-write speeds of 3.1 gigabits per second and 2.1 gigabits per second, respectively. So basically 100% faster than the previous generation MacBook Pro SSDs. And again, when you get back to memory stuff, if you do end up getting to that paging situation, this is going to make a whole huge difference. And another kind of neat advantage that we found out when iFixit did their teardown and some others, the SSDs are now removable. They still have a custom form factor and a custom pin configuration, but it does open up the possibility of potentially being able to do third-party upgrades. The question will become, can you get a third-party upgrade that is using the same super-fast technology that Apple has put in, and what's that going to cost you? You know, is Apple, again, are they really charging a extra cost for the premium components, or is the pricing right in line? And I'm kind of moving toward the factor now that there's been a deeper analysis sort of done of these machines that, you know, Apple was maybe justified in bumping up the costs a little bit. They're putting really cutting edge, high end technology into these, and you're going to have to pay for that a little bit. I know my first reaction was obviously that they were overcharging, but I'm not so convinced anymore. And if you listen to the last episode, you know that I was complaining a little bit. So I'm coming around and, you know, learned a valuable lesson this time around on maybe reacting a little bit too quickly along with the rest of the community. There are some other bits of information that are coming out that are a little bit puzzling that we probably should talk about. Some of the existing Thunderbolt 3 devices that are out there may be incompatible with these new MacBooks. There was a company called Pluggable. They make some adapters, and they were working on a Thunderbolt 3 hub. They discovered that some of their equipment didn't seem to be compatible with Apple's new MacBook Pro. And they traced down the issue. It appears to be related to a Texas Instruments control chip. They claim that devices using a first-generation TI USB-C chipset, the TPS65982 to be specific, those will not work with devices that are using Intel's Thunderbolt 3 Alpine Ridge chipset, which is the chipset that Apple is using in this new generation of MacBook Pro. So Apple is basically requiring that manufacturers have a second generation TI USB-C chipset, the TPS65983, in order for their peripherals to be compatible with the new system. So I don't think this is going to be a big deal now that manufacturers are sort of aware of it, but they are going to have to kind of retool or redo their products. And if you have some existing Thunderbolt 3 products, which there weren't too many out already, so I can't imagine too many people do, just be aware you might run into some incompatibility issues if you've ordered up a new MacBook Pro. Another thing that was kind of a big brouhaha was the potential loss of the startup chime. It was being reported that people were starting up the new machines and not hearing the bong that we all are used to and love. That is gone. That turns out to be true, but it also turns out that it looks like Apple just disabled it in the software. So a simple terminal command can bring it back. So if you're really lamenting the loss of that with your new machine, just go online, do a little searching around, and you can find the simple terminal command that you can run to turn it back on. So that was kind of good news this week. And then I think to kind of ease the pain, to ease the switching, Apple is recognizing that We're going to be in a dongle mode for a little bit while as we move from our existing connectors to the universal USB-C connector. And so they dropped the prices on all of their USB-C adapters this past week. So the USB-C to USB adapter, for example, used to be $19 US. It's now just $9 US. Their USB-C digital AV multi-port adapter, which was an expensive one, it was US $49. It's now just $29, so they dropped it $20. And the new Thunderbolt 3 to Thunderbolt 2 adapter also came in down in price, about $9. It's US, it also had a $20 price drop, excuse me. It came down again to $29 US. And then they also reduced prices on their USB-C to Lightning cables. The 1 meter cable went from $25 to $19 US, and the 2 meter cable went from $35 to $29 US. So they are lowering prices there, so you're going to get a little bit of savings. And if you already have purchased an adapter at the higher price, Apple has been emailing customers and letting them know they're going to issue back credits. If you didn't get an email from Apple, just contact Apple Store support and you should be able to get in on that discount. And then Apple also, because they didn't bring out a new Apple display, they actually announced that they had partnered with LG on some new ultra-fine 5K and 4K displays. They're also offering up a discount to early adopters on those displays. The LG ultra-fine 5K display, it's a 27-inch display with full support for P3 wide color. It has a resolution of 5120 by 2880. It retails for about $1,300 US, but you can now pick it up for $974. And the 4K version of that display, it's a 21.5-inch display at 4096 by 2304. It also has that P3 wide color gamut. It's retail priced at $699 US, but you can pick it up right now for $524. So that's some pretty good deals on those high-end 5K and 4K displays from LG that they worked with Apple on designing. So Apple had a hand in developing those displays. Yeah, they don't have the same style as an Apple display, but they're going to have nice color and they're going to pair up really nice with your new MacBook Pro. So if you've been considering one of those, you might want to pick it up now rather than later. The 5K version, some other features that it has three USB 3.1 ports, a microphone and camera built in, and can deliver 85 watts of power. So you plug one cable in from the monitor to the display and you're getting power and your display connection all across that. The 4K also has three USB ports, but they only support up to USB 2, so they're a little lower speed, but it does provide 60 watts of charging power. The 4K monitor is available now with shipping times at about 5 to 6 weeks, and the 5K monitor will be available in December. IDC's latest numbers on the worldwide tablet market are out, and I would say it's a mix of good and bad for Apple. The tablet market did decline almost 15% year over year, but is up about 10% from last quarter. And the good news for Apple is that they retained their position as the top tablet seller worldwide with 21% of the market. And while Apple did see its iPad shipments fall 6.2% year over year, its revenues actually remained largely flat, and that's thanks to selling higher priced models like the iPad Pro. So that's keeping the average selling price high, which means that Apple's not seeing the revenue decline in line with the shipment decline, which is, I guess, good news. Still, IDC noted that the iPad Air and the iPad Mini were more popular than the iPad Pro, so Apple maybe has a little bit of work to do with convincing people to buy more of those higher-end models. And should they be able to do that, that would be even better for revenue going forward. But as far as the tablet market in general, IDC overseas numbers still seem to indicate that, you know, it is continuing to decline. It will just be interesting to see and watch how Apple continues to react to that. Next year will mark the 10th anniversary of the release of the original iPhone, and many are expecting that a big, big update will be in store for next year's iPhone model. Rumors have already been, as you know, that Apple plans to switch back to an all-glass design. Some people are calling it the sandwich because it's going to have glass front and glass back with a rumored sort of thin metal aluminum frame kind of embedded, sort of sandwiched, like almost I guess like an Oreo in the middle. I'm curious to know whether you'll be able to see that or not. My guess is going to be that they're going to treat the metal like they did the new jet black iPhone, where it's super shiny and it will just sort of blend right into the glass front and glass back. Should be a really nice design, although if you're like me, you're a little bit worried about that glass back and how durable it will be to dropping. Although it's getting better, you know, the latest drop tests on the iPhone 7s show that that glass is getting pretty durable and pretty resistant to dropping. So Apple would likely be confident that they could bring out that model and not have too many issues. It's also believed that the next year's model will be the first to feature an all OLED display for the iPhone. We've seen OLED displays in the Apple Watch and now with the new Touch Bar, but this would be the first time Apple would bring that technology to the iPhone. So you should have a super bright, very energy efficient new display as well. There's also rumors that Foxconn is testing wireless charging hardware. This came from the Japanese site Nikkei. I'm never really sure. Maybe somebody who's Japanese can correct me on that. I'm going to go with Nikkei. They say that they are working to get the yield rates up to satisfactory levels for Apple and that they have been doing some testing. The whole wireless charging thing is interesting to me. The report also says that the feature could be limited to only the 5.5-inch model. And we have, of course, heard reports of Apple researching and potentially bringing wireless technology or wireless charging technology to the iPhone. I think the problem has been is there always has been limitations in terms of range. It still has to be on like a charging puck, and also the speed of the charging technology. So being able to quickly get a rapid charge, get your iPhone back up to charge, is an issue. But we've had these reports that Apple is researching longer range wireless charging technologies, that they've looked into a couple companies. And so maybe when they bring this out next year, you'll actually have a solution where you don't have to be directly right next to the charger, but can be a little bit of a distance away. It can only go so far. But, you know, the idea of wireless charging at this point, you know, it wasn't something I was interested in for the iPhone 7, but if they can solve some of these problems, it does get interesting, especially in light of Apple's decision to remove the headphone jack from the iPhone 7. If they get to a point where they have reliable, fast wireless charging that could maybe even go over a certain distance, would they consider potentially getting rid of the Lightning connector completely? There's a group of us, myself included, who would like to see them switch to USB-C or Thunderbolt 3 for that connector. You'd have nice, fast, wired syncing and stuff like that. But given Apple's track record of wanting to go to a wireless world, if they were able to solve some of these problems, I wouldn't put it past them to get rid of the port completely. It certainly would simplify the design and would look really great to be all sealed. It could help also with the waterproofing, but you'd be relying on wireless syncing and wireless charging as well. But I'm not so sure that would be so bad. I mostly sync over wireless. I download my apps directly from the App Store. I do plug in for charging, but very rarely for doing any kind of syncing. Maybe when I do a backup, I prefer to do it that way. So if they can solve some of those problems, I could see them going in that direction. As far as how Apple is doing now with the current generation iPhone, in the third quarter, It's being reported by BMO Capital Markets that Apple actually captured 103.6% of the total smartphone industry profits. And if you're going, wait a minute, how can they have more than 100% of the industry profits? The main reason is that a majority of the other vendors actually lost money on their smartphone sales. And this also marks the first time that Apple has actually had more than 100% of the industry profits. Typically, they split that money with Samsung. But what happened for Samsung this quarter is they had the costly recall of the Samsung Galaxy Note. So that seems to be weighing into Apple's good quarter in terms of smartphone industry profits. That's probably not going to last going forward, but it did happen this time around. As far as market share, Apple still is in second behind Samsung. Samsung had 21.7% of the market to Apple's 13.2%. So even with having second place in terms of market share, they are way on top when it comes to actually making money on smartphones. And then if you've been holding out for an updated 4-inch iPhone and iPhone SE with maybe some new specs, Ming-Chi Kuo says don't hold your breath. He's not expecting Apple to do a refresh of the iPhone SE in the spring. He thinks Apple's going to stick with the existing model in the lineup to try and keep their margins higher and potentially not eat into iPhone 7 sales. He also thinks that Apple's going to put more pressure on their suppliers to keep their margins high, trying to get the best rates for component parts and things like that. It's something Apple always does. But he thinks the particular focus on keeping margins up has to do with continuing slowing of iPhone demand. I'm not so sure how I feel on this one. There are a lot of people that really like that 4-inch form factor, and I question whether they're going to be willing to wait a longer period of time between update cycles for that model. But as I step back from that and think about it a little bit more, it does make sense. That is kind of the entry-level phone. They probably do not need to update that every year. They could maybe go to it with 18 months or 24 months even and still be okay. But only, I guess only time and what Apple does will really tell us the true story. But I'd be curious to know, if you are a fan of the 4-inch, the iPhone SE model, would you be disappointed, or how disappointed would you be if Apple doesn't update that model this spring? There was an iffy, if not exciting, rumor this week that Apple may be considering a price cut for Apple Music. This came from Digital Music News. They reported that Apple is thinking about lowering the cost of its Apple Music subscription service. According to the report, they say they're in serious discussions and they are ongoing, but that the possible price cut might not happen. I guess they're hedging their bets a little bit. They say the cut could be as much as 20%, meaning that a single person plan would be just $7.99 in the US per month, and the price of a family plan would be dropped to US $12.99 per month. I'm not really sure if this will impact pricing in other countries. There are different rates depending upon which country you're in. The student rate would supposedly remain the same at $4.99 per month here in the States. And this would bring Apple's pricing actually below some of the other services that they're competing with, like Spotify and Amazon's new Music Unlimited service, although it would be in line with the Amazon service if you're a Prime customer, but that's not the rate that's available to everyone. And I think that would be actually a good move for Apple to make. It's also being said that the possible cuts could be promotional only and made available for a limited time around the holiday season to try and entice new customers in. Customers who would sign up under the lower rate if it was promotional would be able to keep the rate as long as they kept their monthly subscription service active. So it wouldn't be like a timeout period or a trial period. It would actually continue on. And that would be a good move for Apple to do as well. That actually is probably the best of both worlds, because they can lower the price for a certain segment of customers, entice new people in the service, get them hooked, get them paying, and then bring the prices back up. And now you have a whole new group of consumers that will probably market and sell the service to their friends and family, because I absolutely love Apple Music, and I would love to get a price discount cut, but even if I don't, the more people that get in there, I think just the better the service is going to get. So I was kind of excited about this news. I hope Apple does just lower it for everybody ultimately, because I think that would make them very, very, even more competitive. I think they're already one of the better services out there, but that would just kind of seal the deal, I think, for a number of customers. So what do you think? If you haven't jumped in on Apple Music, would a price cut make a difference to you? Let us know, maccast@gmail.com. If you were following reports of smartwatch sales and smartwatch sale trends this week, you may have felt like there were two alternate universes going on, because there seems to be a big rift in the analysis of the market. IDC ran a report saying that shipments of smartwatches have plummeted by 50% year over year. IDC had shipments going from 5.6 million units in the third quarter of 2015 down to just 2.7 million in the third quarter of 2016. That sounds pretty grim, like a pretty big drop. But then you had the firm Canalys come out with their report, and they say shipments actually rose 60% year over year. So for the same period, you've got one group saying down 50%. You have the other group saying up 60%. Canalys claims that total smartwatch shipments exceeded 6.1 million units for the quarter. And even more interestingly to me, they had Apple shipping 2.7 million Apple Watches in the third quarter, which would be 0.1 million more than the total number of smartwatches that IDC had reported had sold in the entire quarter for all manufacturers. So I'm just really confused. And I think it really just illustrates the fact that, you know, I don't even know that you can trust numbers from these reporting groups. Now, one thing that I thought about, and I saw some other people talk about this, is that maybe Canalys is counting other things like fitness bands or counting quote-unquote smartwatches in a different way than IDC is. And I will garner that that is likely the case, and that may be part of the discrepancy. But you're talking about 50% decline versus 60% growth. That just doesn't resolve. It doesn't jive. Now, there was one area of the report that, or the reports that they both agreed on, and that was around Apple's share of the smartwatch market. IDC says it's about 41%, while Canalys had it slightly higher at 46%. But needless to say, Apple has a large chunk of the smartwatch market. And they also both agree that interest in the Apple Watch is declining, and that consumers are generally not motivated, or were generally not motivated, by the recent updates made with the Apple Watch Series 2 and the iPhone 7. So smartwatch, you know, I think what's going on is people who were interested in them and really wanted one probably got one. Those of us who like them probably upgraded. But in general, there's not a lot of people outside that segment that are kind of finding their way or making their way to smartwatches. And I think that's likely the case. As I look around and I talk to people in my immediate community, that seems to be the deal. You know, us tech geeks and nerds really like our smartwatches, but as far as it being an item that has broader consumer appeal, I think we're not quite there yet. I think pricing and battery life and some of the other technological limitations are what are holding some people back. Generally, I think those people are going with more of the fitness band kind of solutions. And a lot of those are starting to hybridize and move into the smartwatch category. So I think that's going to start eating away a little bit at what's happening with the Apple Watch. Now, if Apple could get more health and fitness features in there, make them a little bit more autonomous in the next generation, I think that could help. But I think it's going to be kind of a slow, steady growth category, and nothing that's going to really kind of, you know, break out or take off overnight. And that's generally what we're seeing. And then finally, in the news for this week, we talked a little bit last week about Apple delaying the launch of the AirPods. They were supposed to come out in October. Apple said, nope, sorry, we're not going to make it. They are delayed until a later time. They didn't really give any specifics. They updated their website and just put shipping soon or coming soon, I think is what they might have added. But this week, DigiTimes says that the AirPods might not even ship this year at all. They might be delayed until 2017. It's unclear what the cause of the delay is. They just say that suppliers are saying, yep, Apple might not get them out the door in 2016. I think that would be a huge faux pas, and there would be a lot of negative press around that for Apple. So I'm hoping that's not the case. In backing up and trying to figure out, well, what would cause the delay, you would immediately probably think, well, it's that new W1 chip, right? Maybe they're having yield issues. Maybe they're having problems there. But actually, Apple already has been shipping Beats headphones with the chip in it. They have two models that are already using the W1 chip. So I don't think that's the component that's causing the problem. So it does then leave you to scratch your head and go, what's causing that delay? Of course, Apple's not saying anything, and we're not really going to know when they come out till Apple tells us they're here. But as far as, you know, demand in the community, there seems to be a lot of people who are very interested in those headphones. And for Apple to not have them out for the holiday selling season, I think would be a pretty big bummer for Apple and their bottom line for the final quarter of 2016. So hoping that the DigiTimes report, they're not always accurate, and I'm hoping this time around that they're really not. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, if you've got an old iPhone, an Apple Watch, an iPad, and you want to get some cash for it, Gazelle is the place to go. I love Gazelle, and what I love about their service is they make it completely easy to get cash for your old device. It's free to get an offer. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, answer a few questions about what device you have, what condition it's in, and you get an instant price quote right there on the screen. And you don't have to worry if you have a broken device. Gazelle will accept those too. And once you have your offer and you accept it, Gazelle will honor it for 30 days. So that gives you some time to get things ready, to send it in. And best of all, shipping is completely free as well. And in many cases, they will provide you the box to send it back in. Again, they try and make this as easy and as pain-free as possible. Once you send your device in, all your personal information will be wiped and removed from the device. And you get paid fast. You can get paid by check in the mail. You can choose to get an Amazon gift card in your inbox, or you can even opt for direct deposit into your PayPal account. Gazelle has helped over 100 million customers get cash for their old stuff, and they've paid out over $200 million to those customers. So get cash for your old iPhone, iPad, or Mac today. Go to gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. We talked about what analysts and the media are saying about the MacBook Pro, but on the last episode of the MacCast, I also asked you, what do you think? You know, what's your reaction to the MacBook Pro? And I got a lot of great feedback from you this week. Fred wrote in to say he's kind of lamenting the loss of the ports, things like the SD card slot. And I think a lot of people feel the same way. He said, I prefer multiple I/O ports and formats and dedicated power and monitor connections. It's just easy. And I totally get this. I get that, you know, a lot of people like having a bunch of various connectors that they can connect different devices in as need be. But Fred, I think that for me, having a standardized connector that can handle multiple functions, that you can connect and mix and match what's connected to it as needed, I think is overall better moving forward. And I think Apple kind of saw this. You know, you get a single Thunderbolt 3 dock with a single cable, and you can have kind of the best of both worlds. You can have all those separate connections. You can have a USB and an HDMI and a DisplayPort and a Thunderbolt 2 and whatever you want to mix and match on the back of that and connect that all with just one cable that you can dock into your machine. So when you get home, you grab your laptop, you plug in one cable, and you're good to go. And then you still have four other standardized ports to connect to, because that one connection can also carry your power as well. And I like the fact that you can plug into any port and get all the same functionality all over the same connector. So yeah, we're going to live in, you know, quote unquote dongle land for a little bit, but that's also all going to go away as you begin to upgrade your external drives and peripherals. Because the other advantage of kind of having a single standardized connector, both not only just on the Mac, but this is also being adopted in the PC world, as we saw with the original USB, you're going to start to have a bunch of standardized peripherals that are all working off the same system. So you're going to start to replace your cables, you're going to start to replace your external hard drives and things, and they're all going to have this one standardized connector. So yeah, a little bit of pain point and a little bit of transition on the front end, but in the long run, I think it's going to end up being a better experience for all of us. Another thing I got a lot of agreement on was the touch bar and Apple's direction of keeping the Mac experience, the desktop experience, OS experience, separate from the device, iPad, iPhone touch experience. A lot of you seem to feel that Apple's making the right move there. Many of you also seem to like the concept of the touch bar and its potential, but you are also, like me, a little bit cautiously optimistic about its potential. Many of you commented on, you know, the placement of it. Does it make sense with that extra large trackpad that's on there now and the keyboard? You know, there's maybe a little bit of a reach problem. And how is it going to get implemented? If it's implemented in the right way, it might make a lot of sense. But if it's implemented badly by, say, a third-party app or developer, it might just not have the utility that you'd want to see from it. And really, none of us can figure out if it's going to work or not until it's actually out there and we're using it and we're seeing how it's coming together. So that seemed to be a general agreement among the community that, you know, with that particular feature, it's a little bit of wait and see. The one thing that many of you didn't agree with me on was the whole single plane argument that I made. You know, I feel that Apple's doing the right thing in terms of, at least with a desktop, and Phil Schiller commented on this, the L-shaped design of a notebook, it doesn't make sense to be constantly switching from one plane of user interface where you've got your trackpad and your keyboard and then having to kind of reach up constantly and do things on this vertical plane. So going from that horizontal to vertical, to me, just feels like a really not natural transition. It never felt comfortable. And a lot of you wrote in to point out that, well, Apple's already kind of moved in this direction. If you look at the iPad Pro and the Smart Keyboard, that is exactly that scenario. And I agree with that sentiment. I agree that that's the paradigm that Apple is claiming to be avoiding with the notebooks. But I will also chime in and say that I've had my iPad Pro set up for a year and I absolutely love it. I have the Smart Keyboard. I use it all the time. But it works best when I'm in an app where the only interface that I have to use with it is the keyboard. So it's great for note taking. It's great for using Byword. It's great for using Omni Outliner. But whenever I have to kind of break that and actually go up and touch the touchscreen to do something, I have to admit it still feels very awkward. And that's after a year of use. So I think that's the point. And a lot of people are pointing to like the Microsoft Surface Studio announcement saying, hey, this, you know, here it is. Here is a touchscreen, you know, 27-inch basically iMac that a lot of people have talked about. But even when you look at the Microsoft Studio, you notice that there are two distinct operation modes. One is sort of the computer desktop mode where it's in that vertical plane and you're using a keyboard and a trackpad or a mouse, some other kind of input to control what's on the screen. And then you have that studio mode where you're pulling it down, you're using it almost like a drafting table. And at that point, you're switching to their little puck dial thing and a stylus. So it's really in a drawing mode, in a touch mode at that point, and they still are kept distinct. It doesn't really, I think it doesn't really make sense to kind of mix and match the two. The workflow, the user interface, the interactions just don't feel natural and don't really make sense. And just one other side note on the touch bar, I have to bring up a correction. I had mentioned the resolution of the touch bar. I'd gotten off a little bit. I said it was a 2180 by 80 pixel display. It's actually 2170 by 60, and that was confirmed by Apple's developer documentation. So the touch points on that are actually a little bit smaller than Apple requires in their human interface guidelines in some cases for, say, like the iPhone. So it's going to be interesting to see how all that works out. And then another general reaction we heard from the community, especially from desktop users like David, is that they were just left confused after the event. And this is what I think the most negative reaction to the MacBook Pro is coming up. Not necessarily with the MacBook Pro itself, but with the whole Mac lineup. David mentioned he has a 5-year-old iMac that he had been using and holding on to. It's getting a little bit long in the tooth. He was waiting to upgrade, waiting to see what Apple was going to announce. And his old machine is kind of having issues. And Apple didn't announce a new iMac or any new desktops for that matter. And so he's left in this position of, what do I do now? Do I buy the current generation iMac, or do I wait a little bit longer to see if Apple is going to do something? And I think that's really a tough position, and it's left a lot of people in that place. My gut reaction to that, David, is that, you know, there is an iMac update coming sometime, likely in the first half of 2017, but we really don't know. We don't know what Apple's plans are, and Apple's really not sharing that information with us. I think a lot of people would have felt better off if Apple had said, oh, and by the way, we're going to have some updates for the Mac Pro and the iMac or our desktop machines soon. They wouldn't have to give a lot of details, but they maybe could have given a little bit of hint, a little bit of indication that they were, you know, doing something. Now, that's a little bit implied, right? Because Apple's always working on future updates, but we just don't know when. And the 5K iMac in its current iteration, the 27-inch iMac, is a great workhorse. And for you, David, because you have a 5-year-old Mac, I think it still would be a huge upgrade from what you have now. So I don't think that, you know, there's any disappointment in buying a new machine now. If you feel like you can suffer through another 3 to 6 months with the machine that you have, maybe it's worth waiting. But the best advice I can always give to anyone is buy the machine that you need when you need it, and don't worry about what the upgrade cycle is or where Apple is with their upgrade cycle. I also give the advice to buy as much machine as you can afford at the time. So, you know, get as much RAM, get as much storage as you can possibly afford at this point. As far as how I would prioritize that, I would say getting faster storage first. So going with an SSD, if you can, is the most important thing. And then look at memory, and then probably GPU speed, and then the processor last. I think that makes the least difference in this day and age and with determining the performance of the overall machine. Some might argue with me on that, and feel free to do that, but that's sort of how I see things. And when looking at storage, the fast storage, look at your raw storage needs, you know, the stuff that you need on the local computer. And consider, you know, maybe a smaller SSD at first if you need to save cash, and go with externals for your larger amounts of storage. Just make sure, again, that the SSD that you get built in is enough storage for all the stuff that you want to throw on there locally. And that's going to be different for different people depending upon what you're doing. For example, I've made the switch to using Apple Music and using iCloud Photo Library. So those two libraries for me no longer really exist on my internal drive. I've moved all of that off to external drives, and so I don't need to factor that into the base storage of any new machine that I get. I'm going to use that on externals, and then when I'm not at home, I'm accessing that data through my iCloud libraries. But that's just me. If you're the type of person that you're like, I want to have all my music locally on my drive, and I want to have all of my photos locally on my drive, factor that into your storage decision. But I would say at this point, you really want to try and get SSD. I know the Fusion drives are out there as an option. I don't particularly think they're all that great. And a lot of the people that I know that got them, thinking that it was going to kind of be a good halfway point between fast SSD and large amounts of storage, they generally have not been super thrilled. If, again, you have a different opinion on that, let us know. But that's just the general consensus I get from the community. So that's the way I could go. I would go, but I'm kind of in a similar place. I'm confused about Apple's long-term Mac strategy when it comes especially to desktops. And Steven sort of felt the same. He said he was actually very happy and excited about the MacBook Pro announcements, seeing it as a machine that has a great form factor, a gorgeous display, which it really does. And I forgot to mention that earlier. You know, this is really a high-end display with the P3 color gamut and all that stuff. Great, amazing trackpad, huge, amazing interface expandability and flexibility with the 4 Thunderbolt ports. So he's like, yeah, the MacBook Pro is great. But when it came to the other Macs, he really felt different. He says, there's just no defending their completely baffling refusal to spec bunk the regular products, nor their price points being extremely difficult to justify. So he's looking at, you know, the price point on the Mac Pro being a little bit high, and the fact that they didn't do anything with the other desktops that just, you know, leaves people befuddled. And he shared what I've heard from many, which is that it feels like Apple is seeing the Mac as more and more a kind of niche product. You know, it's not their core product. It's not where they're getting the majority of their revenue from anymore. It's still important, quote unquote. And I say that with quotes because it's less important than some of the other things that they do, but they still see it as a workhorse, as something that people need. But because it's becoming this more niche product and they're selling fewer to consumers less frequently, they're doing that thing that they need to do from a business perspective, which is maximize the profit on each unit sold. The average selling price has to be good, and their decisions that they seem to be making around those models seem to be reflecting that in terms of the longer release cycles, the sort of less major upgrades, and the higher price points. And I think we're going to see more of that. I fully expect that the raised price points are going to come across on the desktop models when they bump those up as well. And what's hard for me is that I can't say that David's opinions are wrong. I think they're dead on, but I also can't say that Apple is really wrong for making the decisions and reacting the way to the changing market forces that they are. It all makes sense, and as much as it doesn't feel good to all of us, I think it's probably the right thing to do all the way around. So after a week of digesting what the Mac Pro is, I think I've decided that Apple is delivering a pretty great machine given the timing and the technology that's currently available to them. I think they put together the best package, and that's sort of what they said. That's how Apple's been reacting. They're a little bit confused by the large negative reaction of the community. I'm not sure they should have been caught off guard by that, but I kind of understand where they're coming from. But I also believe them when they say, look, we looked at all the pieces, we considered all the things, and this, we feel, is the best MacBook Pro that we can put out right now. And it's easy to get lost, I think, in the individual specs and the pricing and lose sight of the whole package. And I think I did to a certain degree. You know, after looking at what else is available on the market, Apple's prices still are at a premium, but I don't think they're 100% out of line, nor that they're anything new for Apple. Apple's always been on the higher end of the scale. You always pay a little bit more of a premium for Apple. I had kind of spec'd out some similar machines. I think I mentioned the HP X360 Spectre line. And when I went back and kind of looked at that, you know, I had said there was a significant savings on that. That's true when you're looking at the 1 terabyte SSD models. But if you look at the base models and sort of spec them the same as the MacBook Pro, they're kind of right in line within a couple hundred bucks. And Apple, again, they're using really fast, really high quality SSDs. So you're paying a premium price for that, especially when you're putting more storage in there. So that's likely where the difference is coming into play. You know, I wish Apple was more reasonable on RAM and the storage upgrades, but you're getting what you're paying for to a certain degree. I think Apple still takes a little bit of profit on the top. There's a little bit of profit taking there, but who can really blame them for that? I think I'm having a harder time finding blame in that. And as for rev cycles, I can understand and appreciate that the times have changed. PC sales are slowing, as are Apple's update and release cycles for the Mac. And I can also appreciate that Apple releases, you know, what they feel is the best machine that they can make at a time and releasing it when they're ready to release it, not on anyone else's cycles. They're not bending to the schedules or the whims of their partners. Apple could have easily waited even longer to release new machines, but I think they didn't think that was right. And I think they thought, we've got a really great update with this MacBook Pro. And they also don't make choices without thinking everything through. And that's easy to forget when you're just reacting to an immediate announcement. You know, and from the outside, it can seem like maybe they made some wrong choices. But when you really step back and you do the deeper analysis, it starts to come together and it starts to make sense. And when you have all the puzzle pieces there in front of you, you can kind of put them together and start to see the whole picture. And I think that's really what happened for a lot of the a lot of us this week when it comes to the MacBook Pro. So again, I'd love to hear more about what you think about all of this, what you think the future for the Mac lineup and how Apple is going to start rolling things out is. And I welcome your comments. Send them to me, maccast@gmail.com. So one of the things that happened when Apple moved to iOS 10 and they updated the music app is a feature that a lot of you really liked, because I heard a lot about this when it went away, was removed. And that was the star ratings. Apple went from star ratings to hearts, basically liking music, but you didn't really get to set an actual rating. Well, good news is that at least when Apple rolls out iOS 10.2, it looks like that feature is coming back. Currently, the beta version is out and it is in there. When Apple finally releases 10.2, it looks like you're going to be able to go into settings inside music and toggle on show star ratings, and then it will be back. Now, setting the rating is not going to be quite as simple as it was pre-iOS 10. In iOS 9, you may remember that as the music player was playing, you had the star rating right there, and you could simply tap to adjust it or add a star rating to a track. Now what you're actually going to do is in the Now Playing tab or panel, what do we call those things? Card, the Now Playing card. You'll tap on the little ellipses down at the bottom of the screen, and then tap on the rate song option, and that will pop up a little window where you can set the star rating and you can tap done. So a little bit more complicated than it was in the past. You can also just ask Siri, like, give this song 4 stars. And that will work as well. As a matter of fact, that still works in the current version of iOS 10. So it's a little bit of a workaround to actually set your star rating. So the star rating data is still there under the hood. We just haven't had a way to access it. It sounds like we're going to get that back in iOS 10.2. And one other thing to note on the star ratings, if you use Apple Music, the song must be added to your library before you can give it a star rating. It doesn't have to be downloaded, but it does have to be in your library. Because I noticed when I was trying to set star ratings on some playlists that I had added from Apple Music, I wasn't able to do that until I actually said, yeah, add this individual song from this playlist to my library. And then at that point, I could set the star ratings. And then one other final thing to note about star ratings, if you are using Apple Music, they do not have any influence on Apple Music recommendations. So to influence your music recommendations, you're still going to have to use the hearts, the likes, and that will kind of let the Apple Music curators in the system know, hey, these are the things that I want you to consider when you're making recommendations to me. But good news, if you are a fan of star ratings, they are coming back. Now I want to talk a little bit about app thinning. This may be something that you know about. It may be something that you just heard about. But Mark wrote in to express some frustrations. And it's one of these frustrations that I think we have all had when we do an erase and restore of our iOS device. Or maybe you get a new iOS device and you're restoring from an old backup. The frustration is that even if you do a full encrypted backup inside iTunes and you choose to restore from that backup, your apps won't be reloaded onto your device. Once you've set everything back up and you've connected to the network, what happens is that all your apps re-download from the App Store. And depending upon the speed of your connection and the number of apps that you have, you can end up waiting for hours or even longer for all of your apps to reinstall. And you're sitting there going, I have all this stuff in iTunes, or I think I have all this stuff in iTunes. You know, I used the option that said, hey, do you want to transfer your purchases over to your Mac? And so you're scratching your head. You're thinking, what's going on here? What happened? Why didn't this data just sync back like it did back in the good old days of iOS 9 or iOS 8? I think it's been a while since we had this. And what has happened is in iOS 9, Apple added something called app thinning. And what app thinning was designed to do was to counteract the problem of limited storage on iOS devices and your apps sort of eating up more and more storage. The thought was that as more apps became universal, in other words, the kinds of apps that could run on multiple screen-sized devices, like, for example, the iPad Pro, you'd have one app that would work on the iPhone, the iPad Mini, the iPad Air, the iPad Pro, the 12.9, all of those things that have larger screens, you'd have one app that could work across all of those. But the downside to that was in order for that to work, those apps had to be compiled in a way where they kind of accounted for all the features, you know, like the iPad Pro has Apple Pencil, so you've got to have Apple Pencil support in there and all this stuff in the binaries, or different sized assets. So you'd have graphics that worked on small screens all the way up through large screens. And in many cases, those assets are really duplicates. It's a small size version and then a medium size version and a large size version of the same graphic to handle the different resolutions. And so all of that went into play to making the apps grow in size larger and larger and larger. And so the question became, why do you need to have the same sized asset graphics on an iPad Pro as you would, say, a iPhone SE? And Apple thought about it and thought, you know, we can solve this problem. Why not look at the device the app is being installed on and adjust it on the fly, make it appropriate for that specific device? And that's what became app thinning. It's essentially what app thinning does. Well, and so part of it is adjusting the assets. It's called asset slicing, meaning we're only going to deliver the appropriate graphic assets for the device that this is going to be running on. There's actually kind of three components to app thinning. The other part is something called on-demand resources. This is where an app can, on first install, download and install certain numbers of assets. So good example of this would be a game. You download a game, it maybe has the first few levels of that game, and then as you progress, it can download additional levels in the background and even throw out some of the stuff that you've already completed and not keep it there. So it can kind of purge itself and get storage back as it pulls in more data and information. And we really saw this come into play on the Apple TV. But it's available to other apps to do as well as part of this app thinning process. And then the last part of app thinning is something related to the application binaries themselves. It used to be that developers would use Xcode, they would compile their whole application together, and they would then upload that to Apple's servers to be distributed through the App Store. Now what they can do is, instead of uploading fully compiled apps, they can just upload the bit code or the bytecode right to Apple's servers. And this lets then Apple optimize and re-optimize the application binary for a specific device architecture as it's being downloaded, or I guess probably right before it's being downloaded, without requiring the developer to manually update and resubmit the app. So they can kind of on the fly compile the app that is right for the device that you're installing it on. And so, as you can probably imagine, this means that the app that the developer uploads to the App Store is not a bit-for-bit copy or not a bit-for-bit version of the app that is actually getting downloaded and installed on your devices. And so because of that, it also means that even if you transfer your purchase back from your device into iTunes, the copy that's on your Mac is also likely not the whole entire app. And it's certainly not the app that would run and work on any device that you have in your system. So that version is not going to be able to just transfer. Say it's the version for your iPhone SE, it's not going to be able to just transfer over to your iPad Pro. It doesn't have all the assets. It doesn't have all the information. It's probably not even compiled in a way where it would even run. And so that's essentially why when you do a restore, a full restore, your apps are re-downloaded and reinstalled. And so that inevitably brings up the question, and this is sort of what Mark was asking, is there a way to work around this? And he even went so far as to do a little bit of research into this, and he found a support article on Apple's, you know, a discussion forum article, not a support article, but something on Apple's discussion boards that mentioned a potential way around it. It said, you know, go into your iTunes, go into your settings, go to download options, and make sure you check on the automatic downloads for apps. That way, when you install an app directly on your device, or you do an update or an upgrade, it's actually going to be automatically downloaded also from the App Store to your Mac. And the idea here is that if it's downloading to your Mac, it's not going to know which version is being installed on which device. So it's going to pull down the entire binary. It's going to pull down the fully compiled universal binary of that app, sort of like the old way it used to do things. And I don't know if this is 100% the case or not. I haven't been able to verify this. I've been trying to research it a little bit. But the logic makes sense to me, you know, that that's what would happen. So now you have the full version sitting there on your Mac. And then the idea here is that when you run your app updates, as long as iTunes has that full copy already, a full downloaded local copy, then it should be able to put that back on any device without any issue, and you shouldn't have to re-download it from the App Store. But I don't think it works that way. I don't think you can anymore resync your apps directly from iTunes back onto your devices. As I understand it, because the app thinning magic all happens on the server side, as far as I know, again, I'd be happy to be proven wrong, that the app download and install process has to take place. And that's why Apple forces it to happen after an upgrade. Again, I hope I'm wrong, and I'd love to know that I'm wrong. If you know differently, let us know, Maccast@gmail.com. But Mark, that's what's going on with app thinning, and that's why, unfortunately, you're having to re-download all your apps. And even if you're on a slower connection, you know, it can take some time. Luckily, there is the one little workaround, and I'll just give you this little tip. If you are in that position, it's downloading various things, you should be able to, if there's a certain app you want to get reprioritized so that it downloads before another app, you should be able to go into the app that has the little sort of waiting progress bar circle thing and tap on it. And if you tap on it, that should make it the next app to actually be downloaded. And I've used that trick many times after a restore so that I can get, you know, the apps that I want right away installed more quickly. So give that a shot, and I hope that helps explain things a little bit. Now we have a comment from one of our favorite contributors here on the MacCast, or at least one of mine, and that's Gary. He sends me probably an audio comment just about every week, maybe even two or three. And this time around, he was thinking about something that I thought was particularly interesting and I wanted to share with
you. Hey, Adam, Gary. I've noticed in the new Photos app that on the iPhone, well, probably iPhone, iPad, anything iOS, there doesn't seem to be an improved way when you are, say, going into a postcard app and choosing a new photo, or I think it's any app that uses the iPhoto library as a source. Say you wanted to go into make a postcard, sending it through a third-party app through the App Store, and you click on, you know, your iPhoto library to select the photo. It gives you all of your folders. I think they're called albums or folders to choose your selection, which is nice, but through the iPhone app in the phone directly, you can search, you can kind of narrow things down much faster, almost to the point where the behavior would be to do that and then take a screenshot so that photo becomes right at the top of your what used to be called camera roll. Maybe it's not called that anymore, but the top of the main list of photos that would be available in your third party postcard maker or whatever you're selecting photos from. So early on in the process of the beta for the iOS 10, I suggested that there be an easier way, or at least allow for the opportunity to search by keywords in those third parties. Didn't see anything happen. Maybe it doesn't happen to a lot of people. Wondering if I've explained it well enough that see if it is something that's relevant for a lot of people, if it happens to you. Is there a better workflow? I'm thinking, you know, find the photo in the iPhoto app on the phone and maybe create a new album that's called like third party apps or cards, you know, if you're wanting to do that to make your selection. Otherwise, I guess I just keep suggesting to Apple to allow third parties to be able to search for photos by keyword. Thanks, Adam.
Hey, Gary. Yeah, that is something I never noticed or really thought about until you mentioned it. And yeah, I think you're right. Maybe that's why Apple hasn't really done anything about it yet. Maybe a lot of us haven't really complained about it. But now that you have said it, I think you're right, especially now that Apple has built in the new AI technology into Photos in iOS and on the Mac, where it does the auto keyword tagging. I think it would be really helpful that if in the built-in photo picker that's inside third-party apps, you had the ability to search. Even for something like Twitter or Facebook or anything where I need to find an image from my photo library, to go beyond just having to browse through the entire library or go into an individual album, I think it would be great to have search functionality. I don't know what would be involved in that or how difficult it would be for Apple to bring that into third-party apps, but definitely would be very, very helpful. What I have noticed is that many of my apps do create their own albums when going the other way, and you've probably noticed this yourself. So examples I have are like Snapseed or Bitcam. They both created their own albums inside my photo library, but that was because I was in that app and then I chose to save an image to my photo library. So it does that to sort of better organize. And I guess if you had an app that was like that, you could then go reverse the process and search your Photos app if you know you want to take, like, for example, if now I know I want to take a photo into Snapseed and I don't want to have to browse for it, I could browse for it or search for it in the Photos application and then throw it into my Snapseed album. I guess that's sort of similar to your idea of creating a third-party apps album that you could use. And Gary did follow up with me after sending this voicemail with a tip, and he said rather than creating a third-party album, What he's ended up doing is just favoriting an image right before he knows he's going to take it into the third-party app. So go into the Photos app, find the image, and then tap on the heart button, which adds it to your favorites. And then when you open up the app, you can simply browse to the favorites album, and the image will be right there. Gary, I think I liked your first idea of creating a separate album called like third-party apps or something better, only from the standpoint of it doesn't clutter up your favorites album. The one thing, as you pointed out, with using the favorites is that it's a quicker process. It's kind of a one-step thing. You find the image, you tap the heart, and then it throws it into the favorites album rather than having to, I think, tap the share button. Is that what you use to then move photos into another album or place photos in another album? Yeah, it's a little less cumbersome. But you have a very valid point on adding the search functionality to the photo picker in third-party apps. I think it's about time that Apple probably moves forward with that. Okay, I haven't been able to try out the new Touch Bar on the new MacBook Pro. One, because it's not out yet, and two, I don't get invited. I'm trying to say this without sounding bitter. I don't get invited to Apple's special events, so I don't get to go in a little press room and actually test these things out. And I know that some sites and things have been getting review models of the new iPad Pros with Touch Bar, and I have to say, I'm a little bit jealous. I'd love to be able to try it out. Well, there is apparently a way that we can all try out the Touch Bar, at least if we have a Mac running macOS Sierra, the latest version, and maybe an iPad, but you don't even need necessarily an iPad for this. You can at least kind of see how the Touch Bar is going to work and how it adapts when you open up different applications and stuff like that. And that's pretty cool. I won't be able to try this out, and I haven't tested this out myself yet, but I'm assuming it works because the information came from 9to5 Mac, and they're pretty reliable. They found a guy who has a project on GitHub. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com called Touch Bar Demo App. And what it lets you do is try out the Touch Bar functionality on any Mac running the latest version of Mac OS Sierra. So 10.2.1, I think, is the version that added support for the Touch Bar. If you're running that version, there are two apps that you can get from this GitHub project. One is just a zip file that you can download, and it has a binary, an application that you can run on your Mac, and it gives you the Touch Bar in kind of a virtual on-screen window. And then you can open up various applications, and you can see how the Touch Bar switches contextually. You can click on the items in the Touch Bar and sort of simulate touching it with your finger. And that's really cool if you just want to get a feel for how the Touch Bar is going to react. But really, what you kind of want is the experience of actually using the Touch Bar on a touch screen. And so the other app that's in there is for iOS. You're going to have to download the project files and then build and compile the application on Xcode and then kind of sideload it onto your iPad. But you can do that, and once it's on your iPad, you can attach your iPad using a USB cable to your Mac, and then you can actually simulate the Touch Bar on your iPad screen. So you can call up the applications, and then on your iPad, the Touch Bar will be there, and you can actually tap on it and react to it. I would assume you could kind of put it there in front of your keyboard and almost even kind of simulate the experience of having a MacBook Pro, or even like the potential future experience. A lot of us are thinking Apple's going to update their keyboard to include a Touch Bar, and you can kind of maybe pre-simulate that experience a little bit. So as soon as I upgrade to macOS Sierra, I'm certainly going to be trying this out and playing around with it a little bit. If you'd like to check it out, I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. And if you have played around with this, let us know what the experience is like, if it actually seems kind of cool and works pretty well. They had a video demo a video on the website, and it seemed to be very responsive and work pretty quickly and react much in the same way that we saw with Apple's keynote demo of the new Touch Bar MacBook Pros. So it's kind of cool. Cool little thing to mess around with and check out. But with that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of Smile's great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're welcome to send me emails or audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you'd like to follow me between shows, you can check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.